And you're all set.
Okay, so we are going to try this again, although I'm going to just pause for one more minute or so and just see if we've still got some people connecting to the call. And literally in 1 minute, we will get started. Okay, so we are going to go ahead and get started. I first want to begin this call by apologizing for the catastrophe of trying to get everybody on at noon. So Angela Adams, my assistant, is out on vacation this week, and when she comes back, it would be great if you all could send her a thank you note and just say we really appreciate all the hard work that she does, so we don't have things like that. The advantage of switching over to the Zoom platform, which has more capacity so people will not be cut off, is that we also have the ability to make it somewhat interactive. There is a chat box, and so I'm going to share some comments and some observations, and then I'm happy to respond to questions. As well, we will record this call, so if you want to share it with administrators or anyone else, that will be possible. We will post it out on the Department of Education website shortly. I don't know what that means exactly, but shortly after we finish the call and we get it over to the web folks to be able to get put in place. We have now 95 people on the call. Thank you for taking time out of your day to join with this call. I'm going to spend most of my time talking principally about school and school-related things, which is what you want to hear, but I also just want to set the table by just relaying information from Health and Human Services that risk in New Hampshire continues to remain low. At this point, we still have no community transmission cases in New Hampshire, which truthfully is different from some of our neighboring state or our neighboring state to the south, but as well as New York and some other places where community transmission has taken hold and is resulting in spread. So what that means is that of the six cases that exist in New Hampshire, we know exactly where every one of those people contracted the disease. We know when they did, and we are able to chase down the people who they may have had contact with to be able to begin the isolation process. There are over 250 people at my last observation of individuals in the state of New Hampshire who, because of contact, are in self-quarantine at this point in time. So we're doing a lot of work to try and make sure that we minimize this. That doesn't mean that you guys aren't having to deal with this on a daily basis, and actually daily and nightly for some of you, as I know. So I just wanted to bring you up to speed on a couple of things that are taking place. The first is, this morning, we had and asked the New Hampshire State Board of Education to approve an emergency rule. This is actually an amendment to the 306.18 paragraph A7. And essentially what this rule will do is give you broad flexibility in terms of the conduct of remote instruction for your students. So essentially it says school districts may, and we'll put this language out there as well, but a school district may conduct instruction remotely. The district shall create a plan that shall include procedures for participation by all students. Academic work shall be equivalent, and there shall be an assessment of the work. So it allows you in the district broad authority and broad powers to be able to do remote instruction through that emergency rule. And so hoping that that will help you. And I'm going to talk about days and attendance in a minute. So another piece of guidance that will be coming out to you just after this call is guidance for community events. So because I know many of you have a variety of different events. I've had conversations with many of you. I will tell you when you are thinking about the event, and this information is outlined in the guidance that will be coming out to you. The first thing you're really trying to do is evaluate risk. And so sometimes when people were looking at events, they maybe were just deciding how many people were going to get together or where the event was, and those are all important considerations. But you really start with kind of a risk assessment. And I will tell you that we had one event that was canceled in the state that was a multi-state event. And so this is an example of what that risk might look like. We knew that we would have students coming into the state of New Hampshire, again, where we have no community transmission, from states where they do have community transmission. And there would be students coming into the state where there are some hotspots. And so in abundance of caution, and with the advice of Health and Human Services, that event was canceled. On the other hand, it's quite possible that you have events in your school, and in fact, I hope you do, that are more self-contained. We know that the population of attendees at such an event is highly likely to be New Hampshire individuals, New Hampshire residents, where again, we don't have community transmission. So those would be what's referred to as kind of a low risk event. If you believe that you are going to have an event that is potentially going to bring some people in, maybe you have mostly New Hampshire folks, but maybe you have some grandparents attending a concert, and they're going to be coming up from Massachusetts, you may want to discourage those folks from coming. But a way that one school was able to kind of work with that in their messaging with their community was to say that they would be recording that event and making it available to, on their website so folks could see it. Another option is you could just do a Facebook live stream of that event to discourage people who may be wanting to attend from a high risk area. Another consideration when you're looking at these community events is to consider, who might be attending that event. So even if your particular population is not at risk, the guidance from Health and Human Services is that, older adults, as well as people with some type of underlying chronic medical condition, whether that be heart or lung disease, diabetes, or some type of immunocompromised circumstance, that they would want to consider avoiding that event. And so you may want to put that out in your notifications to the community about the event and just say, like, look, if you're immunocompromised, you might want to think twice about this. And oh, by the way, we're going to be live streaming the event on Facebook, or we're going to be doing a recording, and you'll be able to share that with that community. When you are having an event, it's important to plan for that event. Part of that planning is going to include making sure that you have on hand the ability to, for people to wash their hands, and maybe they have hand sanitizers, maybe you got some wipes, maybe you make sure that your soap is stocked up in the restrooms for people to be able to wash their hands, which is one of the primary ways to prevent communication of the disease. And as well, you may want to send out a reminder about some of those basic hygiene things in your announcement or in your communication about the event. And then finally, reach out to your community health partners. I know that there is an emergency response team in every town that is working closely on these types of issues. And so just make sure that they also are up to speed and are you're closely coordinating the event with them. But particularly, here in New Hampshire at the present time, there is very low risk around most of the events that are taking place. So I wanted to put that out there for you. The next thing that I wanted to notify you about is that we have applied for a waiver from the USDA. And this will affect our many of our food programs. So this is just in anticipation or the possible anticipation that there might be some kind of a disruption in our ability to support some of our students and families that we support with food. And so if these waivers are granted, we won't know, and it should happen relatively quickly. We've actually just applied for those waivers. But it will basically allow us to be more flexible in terms of how we deliver those meals. We'll be able to use kind of grab-and-go meal service. It would open up other locations as authorized distribution centers. So just have a lot more flexibility about how we continue to support our students with those meals. So that is a waiver that we have out there. We also have a request in and are still waiting for guidance from OSEP. They are supposed to be preparing guidance, not just for New Hampshire in this case, but more broadly around services to special education students in the event that our traditional education model is somehow disrupted. And so we are waiting for that guidance, and when we get it, we will absolutely make sure that we pass that along to you. So I also want to talk a little bit about the concept or the idea, guidance on out-of-state overnight filters. Okay, let me go to the chats in just a second. So there's some folks are starting to put in questions in the chats, and I'm going to jump on those in just a second. But it is really in terms of the messaging to our communities. I am trying very hard to support the idea, and I hope that you'll join with me in that, if we end up in a circumstance where we can't allow or can't have students accessing our buildings, or we disrupt access to those buildings, my sort of motto is remote instruction plus remote supports results in remote learning. And I know that you all understand that, but I also know that you all understand the difficulty of ensuring that that happens and that it happens well. And I've had many conversations with many of you, and I know that you are actively working on plans, and they're at various levels of implementation. But I think it's important that we are prepared to be able to move in that direction. Hang on one second, I'm getting a question.
We just want to make sure that people are not sharing their screens. Currently, someone is sharing their email. So if you can just check to make sure that you are not sharing your screens, I believe it's Suzanne, if you could please turn off your screen sharing.
You don't want us to see all your emails, Suzanne. thank you. And so remote instruction plus remote support equals remote learning. And I know that we're all going to be really competent in all of those things, and particularly the remote instruction. But then when I think about remote support, again, I want to think about our food insecure families and those that we're supporting through our various food programs. And then also the remote support for our IEP students in particular, our special education students. And we want to be particularly sensitive to those students who have some medical frailty, and so that we're not creating an environment that in any way puts them at risk, because they would be one of those at-risk populations that's anticipated by CDC and HHS. If we find ourselves in a place of needing to do remote instruction and remote support, we recognize, and are, again, we're working with OSEP, but that the nature of those services might change, and they're so individualized in an individualized education plan anyways. So it may be that that particular type of service can be provided remotely, in which case we can continue to support that student in a remote instructional environment. It may be that we need to bring that student into the school, and we would be able to weigh the risk associated with that, knowing that if there's a limitation and most of the students are doing remote instruction and are not in the school, we may find that the risk is tolerable to allow, one or a handful of students to be able to come in and receive specific services associated with their IEP. Or we may find ourselves in a circumstance where the disruption means that we're not able to meet the service requirements in their IEPs, and we may be focusing on how can we provide compensatory services as we move through these circumstances that we're in right now. And then the last thing that I want to point out is, we're trying very hard to not disrupt our processes. And in my own mind, and this may not be a thorough analysis, but there's seems to me that there are two ways that we are going to end up being disrupted and having to find ourselves moving to a more of a remote instruction type of an approach. One of those is going to be if HHS provides us specific guidance and says, hey, these schools are not safe, a safe environment, then we want to disrupt that education, in which case we want to be prepared to be able to do both remote instruction and remote support. But there's another flip side, and this is the one that I think many of you are experiencing right now, which is community pressure that takes place. I know, having had conversations with a number of you, that the information in social media flies fast and oftentimes inaccurately, but that doesn't change the perceptions of the families in your community. And so what we don't want to do is find ourselves in a circumstance where we are offering instruction, but nobody wants to come to the building. That's definitely not the goal. And where that balance will fall in terms of, you know, when we need to be shifting to more of a remote instruction or not, I think is going to be, you know, individualized in your communities and decisions that I know you all are going to be weighing every day with your leadership teams. And we want to be here to help support you in that process. I'm going to just share two stories of districts that are kind of beginning to work through this, because I don't think that this is one of these digitals you're either on or you're off. We may find that it's kind of a wading into the water. So one of our districts, and I won't out the superintendent, although I'm proud of her for what she's doing here. So she has been working with her team around some remote instructional materials and stuff like that. And they are going to do, she's talked to me about, and I don't know if this plan is finalized or not, but this was the idea that we had talked about, is that next week, in fact, I've got two districts doing this. So is next week doing sort of a disruption day where they actually do some remote instruction and they test out how good are they at it? Is it working? Is it not working? They may have students working remotely, but their teachers would actually be in the school, and they would be, both working on that remote instruction, but learning from each other, figuring out how it works best and how to deliver that best. So it may be a circumstance where you begin to wade into the remote instruction water, and that will do, I think, a couple of things. First, it will increase your capability and your capacity around that type of a new delivery model, but it may also help to build confidence in your community that you are prepared to be able to do something, and that if you find yourself in a circumstance where a family just feels uncomfortable in, sending their child to the school, that you have the capacity to both respect that decision by the family and support the that student in that decision that the family might be making, so that you're not putting yourself in a circumstance where you're saying, like, well, you either got to come in or else you're not going to be there, right? So just trying to kind of continually kind of answer questions and quell some of the concerns that are coming up. And I have to tell you, from having been on the phone with many of you the last few days, that I realize that when I'm saying this, it maybe even sounds calm. I hope it does. But I do know that in the moment, it doesn't come across as very calm for folks. So with that, I'm going to switch over and I'm going to take a look at some of the questions that are coming in on the chat. If you have a question, feel free to type it into the chat. And so I will pick my first one. It says guidance on out-of-state overnight field trips. And again, I think we've talked about events. We did send some guidance out about trip planning. That went out last week. Let me see if I have it with me. I do. And we listed a number of factors that you would have relative to that trip. And so one of the first things I would tell you is travel out of state is becoming increasingly riskier. One of the first considerations on our list is really the location and the itinerary. So if you have travel that is going to be taking you to a location of high risk, then I think that would be a fairly straightforward answer in terms of saying, like, you would want to avoid that. I don't know where that particular trip is associated with that question, but I would reference you to the trip planning guidance that we sent out on March 10th. And if you have specific questions and you want to talk through a specific trip, I'm happy to do that. You can just give me a call on my cell number and I'm happy to do that. So the next question, Okay, where am I going? Excellent. Okay. Will the decision to close be a local decision or a state level decision? So again, it's actually a both and question. I mean, it is possible that the Health and Human Services will declare, you know, a school environment, a individual school environment, or perhaps the whole state, an unsafe environment, and they have the ability by law to prohibit the gathering in that school building. So it is possible at the state level that that can happen. It is also possible, and a number of superintendents have made local decisions about, you know, attending in their schools. Again, I'm going to continue to try and avoid the vernacular of closure, because what we really want to do is if we find that we've got an environment that we think is unsafe, it doesn't mean that we have to suspend learning. We implement our remote instruction, our remote support plan, so that we can continue with remote learning. But, you know, that is, so it depends. It could be a local decision, or it could be a decision that's actually going to happen at the state level. So I think that's responsive to that question. So my next question is, we live where many students have unreliable internet, which makes remote learning through a venue like Google Classroom impossible. It does. And I appreciate you bringing that up, because that is actually an important consideration. So there's kind of a two-step to that. Is one is we have students who don't even have, we may not be in a school where we have one-on-one in terms of Chromebooks for kids. We are exploring options, some funding mechanisms to be able to fill in the gap on some of those Chromebooks. Because of the nature of this instruction, I've been told that that would qualify, like Title I funds could be used for those types of purchases. But then if a kid has a Chromebook, but they don't have internet connectivity, you're going to say yourself, well, what good is that? And so some of the ideas that I have explored both with the team here at the DOE, as well as with some other superintendents, are, you know, thumb drives. So it is possible thumb drives are relatively inexpensive these days. It is possible to load video content on those. So is it possible that we set up, you know, literally going to the old fashioned US mail or US post office with next day delivery, right? And we're sending out a thumb drive to the kid and say, here, kid, and we flip the classroom, they've got some content on there. And then maybe we're engaging with them over the phone, or we're sending a return envelope for asking for them to complete some work while they're at home, and then put it in an envelope and send it back to us as an example. But we're certainly going to have to put on our most creative hats in order to deal with some of our rural locations that are not going to have internet accessibility. And then the other thing that some of the other ideas that have been explored for some of those are it may be that we can't put those students into the school environment, but on, you know, on a limited basis in terms of gathering, they may be able to go to the local public library. All of our libraries do have internet connectivity, and they actually all do have monitors as well. As well, we can reach out to some of our community partners that may be in the area to be able to gain access or work with them. And it would really depend on the nature of the disruption as to whether or not those facilities are even accessible to us or not, or if whether we're having to shelter in place even in our own homes. So I think that, you know, I'm happy to continue to explore ideas, but I absolutely recognize that connectivity could be a problem. And if, and I hate to say that this could be the worst thing, we could actually go to just basic analog. It was not that long ago, and I was alive, when we didn't actually have all those computery things, right? You know, so I hate to think we got to go back there, but, you know, we definitely, it is a possibility to do that. Okay. So somebody is asking a question, couldn't the thumb drives be contaminated? So I would hope that you would purchase new ones that are not contaminated, or that you would scan them before you send them to the kids and contaminate them. If it's possible that your concern is that the students themselves would contaminate those and send them back to you contaminated, then I would suggest that you connect with your IT folks and make sure that we do virus scans across those before we plug those into our network and result in that type of contamination. But I can absolutely assure you that isolation of a some type of a virus on a thumb drive is a doable and a relatively straightforward technological thing to be able to manage. Okay, so next one, does the new guidance on distance learning still have an 80% participation? It does not have an 80% participation. It actually reflects the old rule in there, but I will tell you, it does say, and this was in the old rule too, I always thought that this was contradictory, because the old rule used to say that, you know, the plan shall include participation by all students, and then in two sentences it says at least 80% have to participate. And I'm not sure whose math that is, where all and 80% are the same thing, but I think what we're after is we're after trying to create an opportunity where ultimately we have all students having the ability to access that, but we also recognize that this is a transition process, and it is going to be a little bit lumpy in the beginning for some districts. Some of you guys, I know, I've seen some of your plans, you're just gonna roll. But then other districts are gonna wade into that water. So I think that what we have to do is begin the process and work towards that objective. Okay, next, is there any discussion on canceling spring sports? I have taken a few phone calls on sports as well as some statewide sporting events. So, particularly if those are New Hampshire statewide sporting events, there is no need to cancel those at this point in time, particularly in an environment without community transmission. If it, on the other hand, were an interstate sporting event where you had students coming up from Massachusetts or other states, then I would caution about proceeding with those types of events and imagine that those would probably be canceled. The field trip question is really tied to dollars. Without state guidance, we will be hard-pressed to get refunds from travel companies. Mass has dictated no out-of-state field trips. Can New Hampshire do that? I think, so this, that sounds like a very specific thing, but I think if you look at the guidance that we have provided to you in writing, it will be fairly easy for you to support if you're having to go to a place that has heightened risk associated with it. So if what you're looking for is kind of a blanket, exemption, then if you want to work with me offline on that, I can absolutely kind of work toward that. But I don't think I can, like, I can't offer a blanket, like, no out-of-state travel, because I do know that there are a number of places. I mean, Maine has no cases reported. So if you've got a field trip going to Maine, it's going to be hard for me to put out broad guidance that would support saying nobody's allowed to go to Maine. But at the same time, if you have a specific field trip and a letter from the Department of Education, would be helpful, then we're happy to weigh in on that and help you solve an individual circumstance. And because we want to make sure that you get refunds. I can tell you, we have had conversations, at the governor's office level, relative to refunds and what the tools or the mechanisms are to encourage vendors to be able to provide some leniency to the districts that have trips that kids have worked very hard for to earn and save money to take, and now those are being disrupted. So if we were to do a deep clean in our school, what is a good source of best practices for deep clean? So I do know that there are resources on the CDC website. This is actually the first time that I have received this question, so I will take it as a to-do to follow up and put out some guidance or links for you in terms of what the best practices around a deep clean might be. I have seen that those service master vehicles parked in front of some schools, they're the cleaning guys. I'm hoping that they know what they're doing and that is working, but I can check on that because I don't know in terms of best practice guidance. I do want to comment for a moment. So while this virus is highly contagious, it's also quite fragile. I know that there's been some contradictory information out on the internet. Got to watch that internet. But what I have heard from HHS is that it is fragile. It has a short lifespan. And in fact, on a surface, especially a dry surface, might only survive like less than a couple of hours at most. And so it can, and it's really susceptible to soap. Basically, the surfactant properties of just basic soap just obliterate the thing. So it's one thing to wash your hands, but when you throw a little soap on there, it's really it's really efficacious relative to this virus. So just good cleanliness things is very, they sound so simple, but it is very efficacious and important relative to this particular virus.
Stan shared a link.
Okay.
For cleaning schools.
Okay, good. So Stan just shared a link in the chat about the CDC guidance on school cleaning, which I knew I'd seen something out there about that. So that's awesome. And we'll actually put that out in an email as well in case somebody doesn't happen to be on this. So the thumb drive become contaminated by COVID-19. So fair question. So again, the virus is very fragile, is my understanding. So there's no discussion, for example, of suspending the U.S. Postal Service or FedEx or UPS because of that, because the likelihood of survival is not strong. But I would recommend if that's a concern, that you speak with like your school nurse. And maybe when those come in, you have like one of those little Lysol wipes and you wipe them off before you start working with them. But I think, you know, given the fact that would have to be transported back, the risk associated is going to be probably de minimis. So Washington, D.C., eighth grade field trips, we'll contact you offline. Thank you. Because I do know that there's a lot of folks who have D.C. trips and my guess is that those are going to be discouraged right now. If you were to go through our individual guidance, you might reach the conclusion that it might not be the best time for them. Okay, so that is the last question. We'll see if anybody else wants to jump in with any questions. And while we're, a Washington field trip is next week. So if you have something next week, you can give me a call and I'll walk through that with you in particular. And again, and you all have my cell phone number. If you have questions, feel free to reach out to me. I'm happy to try and, share the guidance that I have. I'm happy. I know sometimes you've had some frustration trying to get through to the Health and Human Services line. They did set up the 211 line now for additional call volume. But if you think you have an emergency or you have an exigent deadline that you're trying to meet and you can't get a responsiveness, you can call me. I can't guarantee it, but sometimes I can get them to pick up the phone, and so I might be able to expedite an answer for you on something. Okay, how about a field trip to New York City in May? So I don't know if you have a cancellation deadline on that one in terms of what that looks like, because May is obviously some time away. If you were to ask me today, is a trip to New York City a good decision? I would probably, based on the guidance that we have out, looking at location, and I know nothing about the itinerary, but just simply the location, I would recommend not going to New York City.
What's your cell?
My cell phone number, which is in case people don't get it this way, they can also get it vis-a-vis many of the communications that we've sent out. I've been sticking it in there, but it's 603-931-2071. How many schools have had foreign trips canceled? So I don't know. We do have the compilation. I know it's almost compiled. We got a list of all the different trips. So I don't know. Somebody's asking how many EF trip tours got canceled. I don't know the answer to that. But I do know that the list was well over 200 the last time I saw in terms of the compilation of various trips. And that did not include, all the little like the sporting trips and stuff like that, around the state. So.
We have school break scheduled.
So they don't have to have remote learning during school break.
No, you do not have to have remote. Those are the question is about remote learning during school break. The way that this rule modification works is that remote instruction counts as instruction. So it is not lost instruction time. It is it counts towards instruction time. So it would not, remote instruction isn't days that need to be made up in any way. So guidance on school trips was sent out. And I will also, I think it's probably on our website as well, but I'll go out and make sure that if you go to the link for coronavirus off of the Department of Education website, which I think links off of the front page, that guidance is there. So you should be able to get the field trip guidance. So if parents want to withdraw their child for a short period of time, a couple of weeks, does that equate to home education? And so what I would tell you is it would not qualify as home education unless they file an intent to home educate, right? Which is an option available to them.
But this is actually kind of a good example of where, as much as we can, we want to kind of respect the decisions of those parents. So if they're thinking, we want our kid out of school, you know, maybe this is where we begin to test some of the remote instruction. And this is where it's going to be most difficult, because you're really running parallel systems. You're trying to do remote instruction for some kids, and you're trying to do classroom instruction for some kids. And so I would just encourage to try and find opportunities to accommodate, you know, families who are saying, like, we're just nervous, we don't want our kids in the school. So rather than try to have to tell them, you know, it's here or it's not at all, try and find an accommodation for them through some remote instruction. And what you may find is maybe that remote instruction, that would be a good, test case, right? So you have a family who's saying they don't want to do this, and they're saying, like, well, I can offer this remote instruction. It's a good test case to see how it works out for you. Mass superintendents wrote a joint letter to the EF regarding vouchers versus 100% reimbursement. Happy to support you guys. I was not aware of that. And I've heard some anecdotal, comments about EF tours and kind of the flexibility. If it helps either for me to join a letter with EF tours, I'm happy to do that. Or if we want to provide a superintendent-wide one, I can work directly with Carl and we can come up with something, but happy to try and lean in and cause them to be as flexible as possible. So the question is, we were having difficulty purchasing disinfectant wipes and hand sanitizers. Are there any state sources that we could access to purchase? So I hate to say this, but the Market Basket in Milford still has some on the shelves. I was there last night. and I know I'm being silly, and I apologize for that, because I know it's frustrating when you're trying to get a hold of them. I can tell you, I don't know the answer to that. I do know that the state HHS has put in some emergency orders for supplies through kind of the national supply. Most of that has been around PPE, which is, personal protective equipment. But let me see if we have access to disinfectant and hand sanitizer, and we could somehow make that available to you. Yep. So someone says, does the school plan for remote learning need to be submitted to the DOE? It does not. It just is the district shall create a plan, which I think many of you have already, but it does not require submission or approval by the department. It is your plan for your community and how you're going to provide remote instruction and remote support. So, okay, so the question here is, for remote instruction, is 1 hour equivalent to 1 hour of typical instruction, or is remote instruction counted differently? So if you are providing remote instruction to a student during a day, that counts as an entire day of instruction. And so I'm going to try and explain this. This is a great audience to be able to share this with, but it's an often misunderstood aspect of the New Hampshire education laws. So under New Hampshire rule, schools are required to provide instruction to students for 180 days a year. Students are supposed to advance on mastery, right? So we don't actually have a seat time requirement for a student. So it's not like a student has to sit in their seat at home for the 6 1/4 hours during the day. You're supposed to offer instruction. And because you're offering remote instructions, that counts as a day of instruction and meets the hour requirements. So we're not trying to count student seat time. We're really after, you know, learning options for those students. I hope that was clear. And if not, you can just give me a call. So if a child wants to stay home for 2 weeks due to family member with a compromised immunity, so that's an appropriate decision. If you've got a family member who's compromised immunity, there have been several of those cases that have come up. Can we excuse those absences if remote learning is not an option? So if you've got someone who's going to be out for 2 weeks, so you have the ability to excuse those absences. That's, I believe, within the purview of a superintendent, but I would encourage a remote learning option for that student. Because really they're making a sacrifice themselves to not compromise the health or put at risk the health of the person at home. And one of the examples I know about is a mom who has cancer and is undergoing chemo and has compromised, an immune system. And the daughter is saying, like, look, I really would like to stay home and not risk my mom, which I think that's a noble thing for her to do. But I would think that we would be able to find some option for them. And if you're not able to find some type of remote option for that student staying home, if you let me know, then we have a variety of resources that we could connect you up with to help that particular student. So it may not be, I may not be able to scale a remote learning system for your whole system, not knowing the uniqueness of your community, but I know for a single student, we can certainly do that. And I would bet that truthfully that there are other superintendents on this call that you could reach out to that would be able to help you find a remote opportunity for those students. Please speak about SAS and SAT. Ooh, you know what? This is the first time that question came up, and that is a great question. So I can't tell you that I know the answer to that right now, but I will be finding that out. That's an excellent answer. Like if we're in a remote learning instruction, we disrupt our ability to deliver SAS. What's going to happen? So I will take the SAS and SAT follow-up question back and work on it. And thank you for putting that on our radar. We're thinking of all these other waivers that we need. We maybe need a federal waiver from the accountabilities thing. Wow, I just heard Zoom sighed. Okay, thank you for the flexibility with regard to our instruction. We have our curriculum in this short amount of time, but we can create meaningful shorter learning experience through the remote learning. I don't know who wrote that, but I think that the way you described it is great. Thank you for the flexibility with regard to remote instruction. We cannot replicate our curriculum in this short amount of time, but we can create meaningful shorter learning experiences through remote learning platforms. And so what I would tell you is that's actually the way that I think that's a great comment, because I recognize, and I think all of you do too, you know, we're moving in a direction. It won't be perfect when we start down that pathway, but hopefully we get better and better at it. So that is the goal, is to, if we move in that direction, to, it may not be perfect, but the next time might be better. And I'll go back to one of the examples I shared earlier in the beginning, which is around, some of the schools that are actually testing their remote capability. They're basically going to do a dry run with some of the kids and see what worked and what didn't. And it may be that first day becomes a flop, but hopefully they learn from it. And so the next time it's not a flop, or the next day it gets a little bit better. So I appreciate the question, because I think it is a great question. And I think it, hopefully, we all have that kind of same spirit of like, we realize that we're walking into uncharted territory, and we're going to learn some things as we go. Okay, and then it says, feel free to contact Melissa White, who at the DOE, for questions about assessments. We are working with all assessment vendors and have plans in place for administration already. Oh, she just didn't tell me about that. Sorry, guys. Okay. Okay, we have three staff members with students returning from abroad. They may or may not return from abroad. I don't know if you saw what happened last night. They will be self-quarantining from home. Is there a risk for those staff members to come back to work? So if you have individuals, staff members who are returning from abroad, if those staff members have been abroad, then my understanding is that they would be asked to voluntarily self-quarantine for 14 days as well. So it says that they will be self-quarantined from home. Is there a risk for those staff members to come back to work? There is, and that's why they're self-quarantining. But if at the end of that 14 days they are symptom-free, then they are free to return into that environment. I would also encourage you, and I've talked to some of the other schools, for those people who are on quarantine or concerned about that, to allow them, we've talked a lot about students, but to allow some of those individuals to work from home as well. So you may have a quarantined educator who, now the teacher's quarantined, but the kids aren't, right? And so they can do remote learning. It's just that the kids will be in school and the teacher will be remote, right? So that may be another way to begin to work on kind of that that remote learning with those educators. I would ask you, if they actually come down with the flu and they're feeling miserable, that you not require that. But if they're just sitting at home and they're quarantined and they're feeling good and they're just being compliant and protecting all of us, maybe there's an opportunity to work on some remote instruction that way.
Access testing window for ESOL students has been extended to 3/20/20 to accommodate school closures and students currently on self-quarantine.
So if it says, if an individual notifies us that they have tested positive for COVID-19, what is our responsibility for communication to our district? That's really going to depend on the circumstances in terms of, you know, where they were. Like, I mean, you know, on one extreme, you know, a kid shows up for school and they're coughing and hacking and they leave school and they demonstrate that they are, you know, and they're positive for COVID-19. That would result in one response. On the other hand, if you have a kid who went away for the weekend and they got sick and they didn't come back into the building, but they tested for COVID-19, but they never had contact with the school, that would be another circumstance. Generally speaking, and this is around some of the guidance that I sent out earlier about siblings in particular, what it is, so if you have an individual who has COVID-19, so we know that they need to be isolated and quarantined until they're fever-free for at least 24 hours. Anyone who comes in contact with someone who is a confirmed case of COVID-19, even if they don't have any symptoms, is required to self-isolate for 14 days after that. If someone comes in contact with someone who came in contact with COVID-19, and the person that who is, so if you have a person who contacted with somebody with COVID-19, they're self-isolating, but then somebody else comes in contact with them. If they are not symptomatic, then that third person is not required to quarantine themselves. If that were the case and you were to follow that logic out, then all of us would be on quarantine right now.
Okay, I am waiting on news from Governor Wentworth. Who closed school due to teacher being exposed by a family member who has tested positive. This is a huge district, I believe the largest in the state. Great, so thank you for that. You know, we're obviously, you know, waiting tests. I will also just let you know that there have been more than a handful, I would describe it of individuals or families who have provided information to the school that said, you know, my child or my husband or my wife is being tested for COVID-19. And the schools have responded to that information appropriately given the assumption about the information. It has turned out that they weren't actually being tested for COVID-19. They were just being evaluated for the flu or something else like that. So simply because someone says they're being tested for COVID-19 may not actually be a case that's being tested for COVID-19.
I don't think Keyberg meant that the staff members were abroad, only their own children. Ah,
okay. Sorry, thanks for that clarification on that question. So basically, we have children who went abroad and are coming back from abroad, and the parent is of those children is a staff member in the schools. So if those children are asymptomatic, then the educator is allowed to continue in school. And if you want to call me specifically about that circumstance, if you think there's a specific risk around it, not knowing where the kids went, you know, that what I just gave you is the straight HHS CDC language. If you want to talk a little bit more nuance, meaning that they came out of Italy or something like that, it might change, you know, some of the guidance. So that's why sometimes it's on a case by case basis that we understand what the guidance is, and then we're going to apply it, you know, rationally to the circumstances we have on the ground. So you can feel free to give me a call on that. So it is unlikely that, a superintendent may find out if they have a staff member who has tested positive. And the way though that they may find out is they're not going to know who that is, because under HIPAA, we can't disclose who it is. Like, we can't disclose somebody's medical condition. But if you have somebody who tested positive, then the investigatory process by the Department of Public Health is that they will reach out and contact everyone who has been or may have been in contact with that individual, because now those people would be subject to quarantine, a 14-day quarantine. And so to make sure that we know who it is, if you know somebody who's got COVID and you were in contact with them, you have a voluntary 14-day quarantine. And yes, it's likely that HHS would be calling you to ensure that you are quarantining.
Okay. That's okay.
So the next question is dealing with, you know, there's been some information going around that if the weather warms and we are able to open windows, et cetera, it will lower the risk of getting the virus, such as when the flu lowers in the spring. Do you know if this is correct? And I don't know the answer to that. I have heard, but maybe some of you have heard as well. I don't have specific CDC information, but that this, as fragile as this particular virus is, it is able to survive the warmer temperatures, which is unique maybe to this, but I don't have that on authority to tell you the answer to that, so I'm not sure. Is this conference call being recorded? It is being recorded, and we will put up a link on our website as soon as we can. That's it for this call, and my understanding is that parents are electing to keep their children home with no medical concerns of child or parents, but out of caution, the child should be marked as absent. So that is a local decision that you will be making. Again, I hope that what we can do is try and find ways as much as possible to respect the decisions of parents and give ourselves an opportunity to test some of that remote instruction. So if you have a parent or a family that is concerned about the health or safety of their child, and maybe they want to keep their child out of school, I believe it's within your prerogative to be able to mark them absent, but it's also within your prerogative, and many superintendents have found ways to do this, to provide them with remote instruction options so that they don't. And really what that does is it gives you the opportunity to respect the decisions of those parents and not tell them they're either wrong because you want them to send them to your kid. And I think that on the back end of this particular circumstance that we're going through right now, maybe builds relationships and helps you in the long term.
Do I understand this right? Once someone tests positive for COVID and then they show symptoms and then they have a fever free for 24 hours and are no longer contagious.
Right, so the guidance that we have from CDC, and you can go out and take a look at it, but if someone were to contract the virus and the virus is gonna run its course, once that has run its course, they basically are saying you have to be fever and symptom free, but fever is a symptom. So for 24 hours before you are no longer subject to that isolation period.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so will the district receive a notification in writing from DHHS should a member of the community test positive? They will not receive a direct notification of an individual who may have tested positive, because that would be disclosure of HIPAA information and they're not permitted to do that. If, however, DHHS becomes aware of an individual who may be in your community and may have had contact with you, DHHS, or and really the Bureau of Public Health, will reach out to everyone who may have had contact with a person who had COVID-19 to let them know that they are now required to self-quarantine for 14 days. So you won't know who it is, but you'll know that they've entered into your community. And so when that happens, then you would maybe, that would be information for you that you may weigh in a decision about what you want to do with your school, your broader school community. So right now, it is a 24-hour turnaround time. They have to, when they swap. So the question is, how long does it take for a test to get COVID-19 results currently in the state of New Hampshire? So it's a 24-hour turnaround. So they do a swab, and then those are taken, you know, and actually there's commercial collection sites at this point in time, and there's other tests out of state that are being done. They do a swab, it gets sent overnight to a lab, it has to cook in some petri dish for a certain amount of time, and they can determine what's going on in there. So within 24 hours, you have the results of the labs back. Which is important to know, because some of the quote unquote rumors is, you know, so a family may comes back from the doctor and says, I was tested positive for COVID-19, and they went to the doctor at 2, and at 4 o'clock they're telling us they tested positive, and it's just not possible, right? They may be symptomatic, that has characteristics, but it can't be a positive assessment at that point in time, because they would not have been able to actually do the test. Okay, any other questions? Okay, it doesn't look like we have any other questions coming in. So I'm going to, again, apologize for the total train wreck of the attempt at a noon call. I'm glad that we've got the technology back up and running and working. And you know, so what we're going to be planning is some more regular of these calls, probably 3 times a week, just to keep everybody on board and up to speed in terms of what's going on. Share some of the information among you. Like, so sometimes I'm getting a question from one person, but I guess somebody else has it as well. You know, but in the meantime, feel free to reach out and give me a call if you have any questions. Thank you so much for your patience. Thank you for all that you are doing for our students out there and for our families. And, you know, and thanks for, you know, right now having to endure. I know that there's a lot of community pressure on you. And so I just thank you for working with that. So somebody just said that they were not on the distribution list for this call. They will be able to, you know, listen to it when we post it up on the website. But if you did not get it, but now you know about it, send an email to Shirley. Send an email to the information at the Department of Education. There's an info email there. And we'll make sure you get added to the superintendent's list. Thank you.